are kind of talking today about the invention of the self and the invention of communal identities, at least as it relates to journey stories and pilgrimages and this sort of this passage of life that we're all engaged in and trying to define and figure out. And so I want to go over a little bit of what we went over the first two sessions. So if you already heard this, I apologize, but just so that people know who are stepping into this for the first time, where we're at in the trajectory of this kind of narrative we're talking about. We talked a lot about the monomyth and hero with a thousand faces kind of narrative arc. And kind of what that is very simple. A lot of Western literature is based on this narrative arc, and most journey stories, most action movies, most superhero movies are based on this narrative arc as well. Starts with the protagonist, who is called to quest. They go out on some sort of journey, and that could be an inner journey, an imaginative journey, an identity journey. It could also just be a trip to Holden and back, or some wild adventure. But in that journey, they encounter the unknown. That's what we talked about a little bit on Wednesday. They, because of this encounter, are transformed in some way, and then they return to their home, their familiar landscape, their community, or to a version of themselves. And that is the piece of this sort of narrative structure that we're talking about today. We're focusing on the return. Where are people here returning to? I'm just kind of curious. Got Minneapolis.
Atlanta.
St. Paul, Minnesota.
St. Paul.
Whidbey Island.
Whidbey.
Seattle.
Seattle.
Omaha.
Omaha?
I don't know yet.
Okay, yeah, it's still up in the air, but someplace other than here, probably.
Probably.
Yeah.
And we're Tacoma, Washington, or a suburb.
Yeah. Tacoma. So, a good variety, not just Minnesota. nothing wrong with Minnesota, it's just a running theme at Holden. I'm going back to San Francisco at some point. But why is the return significant? I want to talk about it in the narrative structure, right? In this kind of storytelling strategy, but also in terms of ourselves. Why is the return significant? Why do we go back?
It's where I'm comfortable and where I have my stuff.
Okay, yeah, you got your stuff there.
Yeah.
Yep.
We can't stay here forever.
Right.
I don't think you fully understand the journey until you return and look back on it.
Right, that's a piece of it. Kind of bookends the trajectory of what you've been through.
Maybe it's a hope to kind of reimagine or change some things up, you know,
yeah.
So that it's a little different than what it was before.
Right.
Kind of shaking it up and then coming
right.
back.
I wonder, for me, if it wouldn't be, I come home and all of a sudden I have this stark awareness that I'm not the guy that left.
Right.
And some people might not like the guy that returned, and I have to deal with that.
Yeah. Anyone else have that sense when they go on some kind of journey? And you could think about this in large chunks too. Say you go to college and you come back to your hometown after college, that you're not the same person who left, or you're coming back with different thoughts, different ideas, right? So why is that so significant to us, do you think?
So we learn something.
Yep.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I wonder if I come back and I'm not looking for some attaboys and affirmation about the journey I went on, mm-hmm. only to find out that, who is this guy?
And right.
So, yeah, it's... And then, and like you're suggesting, is what I have valuable for the people I return to, my community?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what am I willing to do or sacrifice? The gospel in today's, or yesterday's Catholic liturgy was about Jesus going back to Nazareth, and he couldn't work the miracles, and mm-hmm. a prophet's not accepted in his own land.
Right.
And he wasn't the same guy after his baptism and the time in the desert, if you're going to, you know, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Well, you're touching on, I think, the most significant aspect of the return, the reason that we return. It's the idea of community. It's the idea that these stories are not just for ourselves. And these passages, these changes, these modes of transformation that we go through, they're not just so that we can have a better understanding of ourselves, or we can do something heroic and brag about it, right? No, that's how I feel too. I go out on something that I think is really interesting, really fun, really cool. I want to come home with photographs that proved I was there. I want to come home and say, hey, I went to Holden and climbed a mountain peak and it was super cool and I got the hero shots to prove it. But that's not why these stories are valuable, right? It's not why they're valuable to us, and it's not why they're valuable to our communities. So how is the community changed by these things?
Well, isn't that one of the issues about the return, though, that we have changed in some way,
right.
Being like going to college. I don't know that a week at Holden or however long we're here, a short time, makes that big of a transformation. But when we go back, we find that things haven't changed there. They're static, and we now are inserting ourselves with these different opinions, attitudes, beliefs about ourselves into an environment that we kind of expect to accept us.
Right.
But it might not.
Right. Well, I think that is true. You know, you come back and you're changed, and the town, you know, you have this experience with high school, right? You go away for college, maybe, then you come back, and the high school friends that kind of stayed around, right, they didn't change that much.
First year is grim.
Yeah. Or there were aspects of the town or the city that didn't change as much as you feel you have. But I still think that the reason that we seek out these stories, that the people in that town might go to the movies over and over, they might pick up a novel over and over to try to grasp some sense of difference, otherness, another viewpoint. I think it's because we need these changes to be taking place in communities for us to understand who we are, where we come from, where we're going, right? And I think the change happens a lot more slowly in that community, in the place we're from, but it still changes. Holden's different now from when I was a kid, right? But it's also kind of the same, and we were just talking about this, right? There were some, you know, we were talking about the 70s up here. 70s sounded like there were some different things going on, but there's a thread that connects it all. I just think that's one of the aspects of the return that's so significant. You don't have journey stories without the return. they always, you always have to come back.
So if, what if the transformation leads you to something different? Is it not a journey story then, if it leads you somewhere else? It doesn't lead you back home?
Not traditionally.
Not according to this model.
Right, not according to this model. Not according to, like, you know, thousands of years of myth and storytelling. I think that there could be alternatives to this, obviously. You know, there could be ways in which you go to Mars and you never come back to Earth to talk about it. But I think there's a deep need for us to, if we've experienced change, if we've gone through transformation, to try to share that with the community that we know and the place that we identify ourselves. Because, you know, I think that helps us understand the change and understand what we've done. Does that make sense, where I'm going with this?
It was interesting talking to your dad after we'd seen your movies, Cry of the Loon,
yep,
and the one on the railroad, and how he struggled in his desire to keep you safe, to discourage you from jumping off a 70-foot cliff into a lake, and how he said you were such a negotiator, and that and you persuade, and he learned from you that he had to let you go. And what struck me is this wild, adventurous streak in you, and that your willingness to take these journeys, not unlike your Viking grandfather, about whom you wrote this Loon video and poem, and how that's a gift to the human community to have people like you who have the courage. And people do those journeys in so many different ways, but I mean, if it weren't for my wife, I'd be sitting home watching Netflix and listening to sports radio just these last 7 days.
Yeah.
She's a real man in our family.
Yeah.
Norwegian, yeah, by the way.
Right. Well, and there is a way in which, you know, with these interactions between parents, children, etc., you see this happen all the time. You know, I think parents often have to let their kids go at some point in order for their kids to find out who they are and then eventually return. I spent a long time in my teenage years rebelling against my father's expectations, and now we get in a lot of fights, and now we're buddies again, because I found my way back to him.
Exactly.
And you see that story a lot in the Bible. You know, it's the prodigal son, it's Jacob, and, you know, all these different versions. But, so I'm going to ask another question that's related to the same idea. But why do we tell stories in the first place? What's the point of putting any of this stuff to language?
It does something to us.
What'd you say?
It does something to us. I remember my kids wanting to watch the same things over and over again, or the same books. We had to read the same books over and over again, and I was going crazy. And my husband said, it's doing something to them. Mm-hmm. It's speaking to them in a way that they want to engage in it one more time.
Yeah.
I think it's something about the sharing.
Yeah.
My first full-time job out of college was coordinating a program for high school youth to come to a seminary campus for 2 weeks and then do an immersion program in Mexico for a week. And one portion of the program that had been written in was giving them the opportunity to figure out how they were going to share that story at home, because they weren't going back the same person that they came through the program.
Right.
And so often they were like, nobody's going to believe us. Like, how are we going to, like, and so they literally just needed to hear. We read biblical stories and said, all right, so this is how their experience was shared. How can you share the good news, is what we would say,
yeah,
from your experience, home to your community, and then we would ask that the communities hold that space for them.
Right.
And give them the opportunity, whether it would be in sermon form or in Sunday school, and say, you know, tell us your story.
Right.
And then they would get to hear it and experience it through, you know, that youth's language.
Yeah.
Shared experience, even if you're not there with them.
Yeah.
I ran across a story of my great-great-grandmother wrote in 1938 about Pioneer Days. Hmm. And it was so interesting to see what her life was like during that time compared to what my life was like.
Hmm.
And it has prompted me to write stories of my life. And hopefully I can pass that on to my grandchildren.
Right.
Because the life that I'm leading is totally different.
Right.
Than the life that they are leading.
Right. But you're continuing that lineage and mm-hmm. continuing that story that stretches across. Yeah. It's a great reason to do that.
Well, I think when you hear stories from others, it inspires you also.
Right.
And, you know, my great-grandmother came from Norway in 1867.
Right.
With five children and a widow, and she was a widow.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And to me, when I think about, you know, her doing that with the children, and, you know, she was a single adult.
Right.
It just inspired me. I had to see where she came from. I had to go there. It just, you know, and see the place.
Yeah.
And that is an important piece, because that does inspire you to carry the story.
Exactly.
I was thinking two different things. One is that I think those of us in a community who aren't doing the journey, we have this yearning to know what's out there in the world and what's it like, and then sometimes that when people come back from a journey, then that inspires us to take or go to the same place or something.
Right.
The other thing I was thinking of, why we share those stories, I think we have this yearning, I guess, for like a validation of our own experience, our own feelings, and that when we can read a story about somebody who has experienced something similar to us, that helps. Sometimes it just helps us to know that we're not alone, or I lost a baby in between two of my kids, and I didn't know how to grieve it until I read someone's memoir, a woman who had also lost a couple of children, and that was what helped me to kind of begin figuring out how to grieve. And then she was much, you know, older, she was writing like 20 years in the past, and so like she had gone on to build this beautiful life, and it helped me to see there was a life beyond that. And so I think there's a lot like that, where it's, we need to hear what other people say.
Right.
And what their experiences it are. So.
Yeah.
So I just moved into senior housing 10 days before I came here for 5 weeks. So I have a place to go back to, and I know it's going to be different. So
mm-hmm.
my return is basic community, but not the same place. So it's new.
Hmm.
But one of the things that I know about living in communities like this is that people love to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made a joke years ago that there were rules. I was going to have my own place like this, and there were going to be rules. And one of them is, you can't say, "Don't tell that story, I already heard it." and what I believe about it is that everyone has something important to say.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be important to you at that moment, but it's important to the other person. And
yeah.
if you listen and make connections, and my pastor gave it a really wonderful name. She called it the Ministry of Listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if that could be my ministry in a place like that, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, I like that idea.
Enriching both for me and for the people who are telling their stories.
Right.
You had something?
No, it's not right now.
Yeah, well, a big part of the reason we write and we tell stories and we try to write poems about our experiences or songs is to understand other people and understand ourselves through the lens of that sharing, okay? We don't put things into words because we don't want to communicate, right? We put things into art, into language, because communication with some audience, with some group, is inherent in part of that process. And we might not think about it that way, but why do we want to put it into words? Why do we want to put it into a narrative form? Why do we want to identify ourselves by saying, I was this person, I was born in this place, I went and did these things, I went back and it was different, I went and did another thing. Why is that such a crucial part of the way we think about ourselves?
It explains who we are now.
Mm-hmm. And who, where we're going, maybe.
And
I think a lot of this effort is a collective human effort, right, to understand and identify communities as they were, as they are now, as they will be, okay? And we're involved, whenever we tell stories, we're involved in that lineage. We're involved in a great lineage of human identity across time. And you studied storytelling even back to like the Chevet caves, you know, in France, where they have, you, anyone seen those pictures of bulls and lions on the wall?
Mm-hmm.
There are also handprints all over those caves, and if you've seen that Werner Herzog film, he kind of highlights that, but multiple people drawing in those caves over thousands of years, right, before they got closed off. But you see these animals that they're hunting, you see these dramatic, you know, kind of action moments, but you also see handprints. And that's just people saying, you know, I was here. It's the same impulse that graffiti artists have, just scratching their name into a wall and saying, you know, Kilroy was here, or, you know, whatever it is. It's a part of the human process. It's a human story that we're all engaged in. But to do it right, we have to return and we have to share it with the community. And you see the people who are engaged in this type of story, the journey story, whatever, always take it from the I, or at least there's an effort to take it from the I, this is my experience, to the collective, to the we, to, okay, this is not just mine, but our experience. And I want us to kind of look at that in terms of some of the poems that I included in the packet. But I've been sharing stories of my own at these sessions. So I was gonna just share a little story that I think illustrates some of this. And it's about my fear of sharks. Okay, I have a terrible fear of sharks. And always haven't. I was raised in the Midwest, born in the Midwest, never really spent any time at the ocean growing up. So I shouldn't be afraid of sharks. But when I was 7, at the cabin, we got into water sports, and it was water skiing, you know, tubing, and I was really into kneeboarding at this time. And if you've seen kneeboarding, you get towed by the boat and you're on your knees, right? And my dad started taking me out, and I would go do tricks on the waves and everything. And I started getting more and more interested in doing more tricks. And one day he took me out and I said, all right, Dad, I want to catch some big air. Can we find some waves where I can really launch on these things? And so he's driving around the lake and we spot this boat that is one of these big-bottomed boats that kind of sits low and it's meant to produce a big wake. And he points at it and I see him pointing and I say, yeah, let's go try to hit the waves. So he drives straight for these waves, and I'm about, I don't know, 70 pounds, right? So when we hit the first set of waves, I just get launched on this kneeboard up into the air. I clear the trough on the first wave set, land on the back of the other wave, and then just get blasted into the air. And I was about probably 8 feet up in the air, okay? And I remember when this happened, I had never really been launched suddenly that high. And I was like, whoa, the world looks smaller now. And, you know, I'd never been in a plane before. And it was very disorienting. And I just came down nose first and just crashed. And I was just head over heels, washing machine, tumbling. And totally got the wind knocked out of me. And my dad comes back and he says, whoa, you're really wiped out there. Do you want to get back in the boat and ride back to the cabin? And I was trying to be a tough kid, and I was like, no, I'll keep riding. You know, you can pull me, and we just go back to the cabin, I'll be okay. But I get back on the kneeboard, and he starts driving, and I'm noticing that I'm shaking, and I'm just kind of nervous, you know, and I don't think I'd ever been rattled in that way before. And so we start getting back to the cabin, and I'm like, okay, you know, just hang on for a little bit longer, and then I can get into the shallows. And out of nowhere, like in a nightmare, this boat just comes in front of our boat again, right? And the wave comes again, and my dad wasn't thinking, and he just plowed right through it. And the exact same thing happened. Just boom, 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 and then I flew up and then crashed again. And this time, I was, you know, fully incapacitated, and I was lying on my back and couldn't even swim, really. And my dad came back and he was like, ooh, sorry about that. Didn't really think that was going to happen again. And so he has to haul me into the boat. And I'm really, really rattled now. But we get back to the dock and get on shore and go up to the cabin. And it was the end of the summer. So we didn't get back in the water. And I went home and kind of felt like everything would be okay. However, 2 weeks later, my brother and I watched the movie Jaws, and we had somehow convinced, I'm not painting a great picture of my parents right now, but we had somehow convinced our parents to let us watch Jaws, and we were like, yeah, it's about, you know, fish, it's a nature film, and they were like, well, it's Steven Spielberg, it can't be that bad, right? So they let us rent Jaws from the movie store, and I was 7, and my brother was 4, right? We were really excited to watch this. So we get the TV all set up in the basement, and we fill up this fish bowl full of water, and we put it on top of the television, and my brother has gotten a glow-in-the-dark shark that he has found in a fruit snacks box, right? And we push play on the movie and then ceremoniously drop the shark into the water, and it sinks down. But we had filled the bowl so full of water that water just poured out down the TV and just all down the front, right? It got into the electronics. And we didn't know that water and electronics didn't mix that well when we were kids. So we keep watching the movie. And if you've seen that movie, the first scene is really scary, right? There's a shark attack that happens in the first scene. And while this is happening, the TV starts like going crazy. And the volume starts going up and down. The colors get tinted. It's green and red and blue. And it starts fading in and out. And the voice sounds weird. And it's very like, you know, kind of Ghost in the Machine-y kind of thing. It feels like something's taken over the television. And we're watching this girl get eaten alive by a shark. And eventually the TV shuts off altogether, but we'd already seen too much. I don't know exactly what happened in my brain, right? But the next year we went up to the cabin, and the first time we run down to the water to get in, and I have a panic attack. And I step into the water, and suddenly I'm seeing sharks just attacking me everywhere. And you know, I'd feel I'm getting my feet, and I'd have to look behind me, and I'd see fins coming out of the water, and totally irrational. But this fear stuck with me, and I couldn't shake it. And it would happen in the public pools, swimming pools. It would happen in rivers. It would happen in the bathtub sometimes. If I close my eyes too long, start to think a shark was coming. And it was really bizarre. And I didn't really talk about it to many people because I was sort of embarrassed about it. But I never went in the water alone, ever. Even just 2 feet of water, I was always making sure people were around me. But I got into skating during this time, right? And ended up going out at the end of high school to San Diego to skate professionally. And you know, this videos, magazines, that kind of thing, and skating a lot with my friends. And me and some of my Midwestern friends who had all grown up sort of despising the Midwest and always wanting to get out to California where all the cool stuff was happening, we all loaded up a van and road tripped out west and you know, got some apartment in the suburbs in San Diego, and it was kind of a crappy apartment, but we thought we were living the life. But one of the things we started doing was going to the beach because we'd never lived by the ocean, right? So my friends start boogie boarding all the time. And we all buy boogie boards. And I knew that I had this fear. And I was like, look, I've had this irrational fear my whole life. I don't know what it's about, but I need to get over this. And now I'm finally at the ocean where there might actually be sharks. I need to just suck it up and do it, right? So we keep going, and I get more and more comfortable going out, but I'm always going out with a group of friends, right? It's always all of us going out at once. One day, there were big waves, right? 6-foot waves coming in. And we're out there boogie boarding. There are about 4 of us, and we're watching for the waves. And all of a sudden, about 30 feet out, I'm the only one looking. But I see these 2 fins rise up out of the wave and go back down. And I almost thought I imagined it at first, because I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been afraid of for years. And now I think I just saw it. And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, I think I just saw a shark. And they were like, shut up, like, you're messing with us or whatever. And I said, no, look out here. And this time, about 20 feet away from us, we see these 2 black fins rise up out of the wave and go back down. And we're all from the Midwest, okay? So we've never seen anything like this. And we just all turn around, our faces go completely white, and we just start paddling as fast as we can into shore, thinking that we're gonna get our legs bitten off at any minute, right? So it's, and again, these waves are big this day, so we're kind of getting thrashed in the waves. Tipping over, falling, losing our boogie boards, scrambling, yelling to each other, like, watch out, like, we gotta get in. And we look into shore, and our girlfriends are sitting on the shore, and they're yelling and pointing out into the waves, and we're like, we know, there's a shark out there, like, we're trying to, and they're like, and we can't hear what they're saying, but they're pointing. And it just felt like a scene from Jaws, you know? I was like, I'm in the movie Jaws, and now I'm facing this, like, terrible nightmare. So we all paddle in, we collapse on the sand, we're completely exhausted. And our girlfriends are looking at us and they're laughing. And we're like, we almost just died, you know, what's so funny? And they say, it's just dolphins out there. There are dolphins playing in the waves. We were trying to tell you they were just dolphins because they saw us freaking out. But something happened then where I just started to get over this fear. I was like, look, that was about as bad as it's ever going to get. You know, I was facing this situation, and I came, you know, to the moment when I was about to get eaten by a shark. And I'm still here and I'm okay. And so I started to surf after that, and I started to go out by myself in the waves, and I started to learn how to surf, and I still get a little nervous sometimes out there, but I don't have panic attacks anymore. So that's just a little kind of coming of age story about that weird fear of sharks. I mean, I think a lot of people have a fear of sharks from that movie. I think it was like a plague.
Did you hear the background music when you were... I can just envision the music.
Yeah, that was probably part of it too. It was a very effective film. So I've thought about that a lot, and I've thought about what that story was really about, right? Because in the living of it, I thought it was about a fear of sharks, right? Quite literally. I see a shark fin, I feel like I'm going to get eaten. But what do you think that was really about? This is after some, like, therapy and psychoanalysis.
Not being in control.
Okay, yeah, that's part of it.
I would think there would be some, like, sense that your dad didn't protect you, or your dad let you get hurt in the water, and
right.
So now going in the water is not a safe place for you.
Right, that's a piece of it too.
So it's a sense of the unknown because you're from the Midwest and
yeah.
Sharks are the unknown for you.
Right, that's what my therapist said, those two things. It's fear of being abandoned, fear of, you know, not having my father around, but a fear of the unknown. And this journey that I was on, if I think about it that way, moving out to California was about leaving home and about leaving my parents behind and about leaving my father behind. And the shark, in some way, represented my dad, right? And represented my fear of just being on my own. And so I think in this story, the way that I kind of built it in my head, it was important that I was going through this with my friends from the Midwest who were also on their own and away from their parents for the first time. And I think that's what kind of helped me through this thing, right? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
How I kind of like, because this is, again, this is a story that I was aware of when it was happening. I told it for, you know, a couple years afterwards, but I didn't really know why it was important to me. And then through some therapy, you know, that became clear.
It's interesting about your father.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't intentionally do that.
No.
It was a careless act on his part, probably. But,
yeah.
But you know, as a parent, I know along
yeah,
the way we do those things.
Of course.
We don't think through step by step.
Right.
But as a child, that's not what you see in the parent.
Right. It's a different view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, he's here in the village right now. So,
nice.
You know, if you want to have a chat with him.
we did.
So where's the return?
So the return is to the Midwest, you know, and this is how these returns work. It's not always a physical return, but it was with my friends, all of us collectively, thinking that we're out of our element and we're too far in, too deep in, and going through that with them was, in my mind, the return in some way.
So there wasn't ever a physical return or a return?
Well, I could, you know, I could probably narrate it as in, you know, 5 years later I went to the cabin and kneeboarded again and I was okay. And my dad towed me in the boat and that kind of thing. That's probably, that happened, that's all true. But I think for me the end was that laughter and people just saying, look, there's nothing to be afraid of here. You know, and kind of going through that with my friends from the Midwest.
How do you distinguish that from the moment of transformation?
Well, I think in that story, it's kind of happening all together. Sometimes, you know, you think of the story structures, sometimes the climax happens like right at the end of a story. Sometimes the inciting incident is the exact first thing that happens. But those always happen near the end, near the beginning. You know, these are all approximations. But, yeah, I think if this were, if I was telling this story to somebody that studied narrative, you know, if Joseph Campbell heard it, he'd probably say, oh, that was the return, you know. And you went through this with your friends, yeah.
Well, it seems like while you went out with your friends and you returned home with your friends, because they didn't have the same history you did with sharks,
right,
your personal experience had to be pretty unique.
Yeah.
And then I'm wondering if in the arc of this story, as you call it, when somebody like a therapist helps you interpret it,
mm-hmm.
that's like a level. But I'm just wondering if as you teach this and repeat this story,
mm-hmm.
if there's a possibility you're discovering other things.
Sure. Always, you know, and again, the art of storytelling is an art of revising. You're constantly revising. Even the true life stories that you've gone through, there are things that you leave out, there are things that you highlight, right? And we're always doing that. Even the stories that we think came to our lives most naturally that we tell, our brains have already edited those a lot before we tell it to an audience. And the significant thing, again, about the return is not going home. It's not the home. It is the community, right? It is when that I becomes the we. So when the lens expands to the collective, that's the important piece, the sharing of these stories.
So were you sharing the story in some ways with your friends who were with you?
Yeah, I mean, there was more to the story. One of my friends, there's a lot to that story, actually. One of my friends had actually seen one of his other friends get eaten by a shark when he was younger. So we went through that together and kind of processed a lot of that. And then he was telling this story that was a real story of this kind of thing. And I just don't include that in there because it's too real, almost. because he used to be a pro surfer before a skater, and so he had, and that was a different thing because he wasn't one of the Midwesterners, so I don't include him. That's an omission, right? The important piece is the we. Is the collective. So let's look at some of the ways that poets have done this and see if you can see how this works. And then I want us, maybe in 10 minutes, I want us to do some free writing where we try to tell a story of our own that moves from the I to the we. But I'll show you how this works. Oh, yeah. So, Traveling Through the Dark, this poem. William Stafford poem. This one's kind of a narrative poem. Traveling Through the Dark. Traveling through the dark, I found a deer dead on the edge of the Wilson River Road. It is usually best to roll them into the canyon. That road is narrow. To swerve might make more dead. By glow of the tail light, I stumbled back of the car and stood by the heap, a doe, a recent killing. She had stiffened already, almost cold. I dragged her off. She was large in the belly. My fingers touching her side brought me the reason. Her side was warm. Her fawn lay there waiting, alive, still, never to be born. Beside that mountain road, I hesitated. The car aimed ahead its lowered parking lights. Under the hood purred the steady engine. I stood in the glare of the warm exhaust turning red. Around our group, I could hear the wilderness listen. I thought hard for us all, my only swerving, then pushed her over the edge into the river. So it's a hard poem, and you can see probably the, at least the protagonist, the encounter with the unknown, and the transformation and return happening kind of at the same time at the end. But how does this poem do that?
Well, I'm assuming that the group is three. The doe, the pawn, and the man.
Right.
And he includes them. I mean, he defines that group.
Yeah.
Aren't included in that those that are coming on the road afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
The we becomes collective.
Right.
Yep.
And that is the reason he's willing to do the hard thing at the end.
Right. Yep.
And really, he had no choice.
Right.
If he's going to protect others.
Right. This poem also in Journey Stories is kind of a moral crossroads. We're not talking about that in these sessions, but that's a significant piece that often comes in these stories where there's a moral decision that has to happen. But if there's a turn in this poem, where a change takes place, where do you think it is?
It discovers the fawn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when he realizes that she's pregnant, at the beginning, he's kind of approaching it like a routine kind of thing. Oh, roadkill, gotta throw it in the ditch, right? But then he notices that she's pregnant, and it becomes a different kind of decision. And then as that scene expands, and there's imagery that is kind of symbolic that's tying with the red color and the exhaust and the dark and what's able to be seen and not seen. But then he expands from the eyes of my decision to the wilderness listening, right? He becomes aware that it's not just him, it's a larger environment that he's in with larger considerations. I thought hard for us all, right? And then he pushes her over. But again, like, it's a sad poem, but you can see how that expands, right?
It sure, I mean, since we've been talking with Hal about wisdom literature and one guy said, how much we live in our heads as opposed to how much we engage and experience, and how Stafford is so good at reproducing this experience so that mm-hmm. we can move into it
right.
and be there.
Right.
And all these suggestions, so much more happens that I'm aware of until people start to break it down.
Right.
Gosh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So let's look at Passengers by Billy Collins, next one. Anyone know Billy Collins? Yeah.
Where is that?
Next page. Two pages, yeah.
Right. Page.
Passengers. At the gate, I sit in a row of blue seats with the possible company of my death. This sprawling miscellany of people, carry-on bags and paperbacks that could be gathered in a flash into a band of pilgrims on the last open road. Not that I think if our plane crumpled into a mountain, we would all ascend together, holding hands like a ring of skydivers, into a sudden gasp of brightness, or that there would be some common place for us to reunite, to jubilize the moment, some spaceless, pillarless Greece where we could, at the count of three, toss our ashes into the sunny air. It's just that the way that man has his briefcase so carefully arranged, the way that girl is cooling her tea, and the flow of the comb that woman passes through her daughter's hair. And when you consider the altitude, the secret parts of the engines, and all the hard water and the deep canyons below, well, I just think it would be good if one of us maybe stood up and said a few words, or, so as not to involve the police, at least quietly wrote something down. So, humorous, you know, the way Billy Collins' poems are. But how is this poem doing some of that same work?
The detailing of the people around him.
Yeah.
Of what he's seen as community.
Yep, yeah.
In that space.
Yeah.
Just the ways he uses language, possible company of my death, and band of pilgrims on the last open road, and things like that.
Yeah.
Things we think about, but we don't, you know, as we're getting ready to get on a plane, but not quite like this, but in a way, you know, he has a way of saying it.
Right.
It is, captures it in a kind of a humorous way, you know, dark humor.
Do you think there's a particular point that you point to as like the moment of transformation, or is the whole thing the transformation?
Well, I think, so it's slightly cynical at first, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, he's joking about it, and he's kind of saying, look, we're not in the Odyssey anymore, right? We're sitting in an airport, and, you know, it's kind of silly to think that these people might be the last people that I see alive, right? But then, when this, you know, he kind of goes through what the journey narrative would be, right? Pilgrims on the last open road, ascending together, you know, pillarless Greece, and you know, they, you know, get immortalized in some way. But when he says, it's just that the way that man has his briefcase, I think there's a turn where he's noticing in this minutia a tenderness and that collective we, where he, at first he's thinking of the I and kind of objectively looking at the scene, and then he says, but here we are doing this all together, right? And then we get that moment at the end, which is kind of the job of the writer, right? He's saying at the end, I'm the writer, so I should just write this down, right? Quietly. but Billy's good at this. You know, his poems are aware of themselves as they're unraveling, right? So he is writing this journey narrative as he's joking about the journey narrative. And he is including the collective as he's sort of picking people apart. But then at the end, he's saying, that tenderness opens up and he says, I'm the one that's writing a story about us all, right? And it's not just me on my plane, it's all of us, actually, sort of as a contemporary band of pilgrims. So, yeah, I think that turn is just there, at that spot. So, why don't we try to do this? Why don't we, I want us to take some time and just write a little bit in which we're trying to transform the I into the we, okay? And you can think about this, if you can write the whole journey if you want to, this whole arc about the trip to Holden, or, and then the return at the end back to the collective, the community that you're from, wherever you're going back to. Or you can center this just on the moment of transformation. The Billy Collins poem is kind of centered right on the moment when he's saying, he's joking about it as himself only, and then he's kind of like, ah, but we're all in this together, right? Wilson River Road one, that's compressed into that moment of the crossroads moral decision making. If you've had a, we talked about encounters with the unknown on Wednesday, and we wrote about some bear encounters and some hikes and encounters with deer, and you can focus it on that moment if you want. But try to begin in the eye and then open it up to the community that you'll be returning to or that you want to share this with. Does that make sense? 5 more minutes, so we can just keep working on it. All right, if you want to kind of find a finishing point, you can draw an ellipsis or a dash, finish it later. How'd that go? What was that process like?
It was fun.
It provided some structure for my easily distracted thinking, and it was helpful, really.
So did you write about returning to a community,
well,
to a...
Yeah, what I wrote about was just coming here, and my wife was trying to have me look ahead and see what it was, and I refused to do any look anything about Holden. Came here, and then just trying to find out where we were going to sleep in a double bed. That was impossible. And then just trying to get settled, and then coming to dinner and seeing the people that came with us from Trinity, and then starting to meet people gradually, and then going to these classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they were just so enlightening and helpful. And I met these fellow travelers who were Lutherans, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. What could they tell me? And struggling with the question, how to bring the more abundant life of Jesus home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's what you posed to me in the snack bar line last night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did he give you enough ice cream, though?
Oh, plenty. It was a very generous serving.
He was the volunteer last night.
It was very good. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Volunteer
that.
Scooper.
Yeah, we saw that.
Yeah.
Mine was a thought from the hike today. I went up to Holden Lake, and when you're going through the forest, the ground becomes hollow.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean.
And I was like, what's going on? I mean, why are the roots so... I mean, I just couldn't really figure it out. So that was kind of on my mind, this hollow forest floor. And then looking up at the trees and just... Some of them are so big, just so big. And I work at a senior living community, and I started thinking about the big trees that have allowed me to rest in their branches, have allowed me to sit at their trunks and listening and sharing, and just really giving thanks for that, and knowing that I've been in many hallowed forest floors.
Yeah, I love that.
Through life.
I wrote about coming here. My daughter had said to me, "You usually see somebody you know there," and I said, "Well, not always, you know, I mean, sometimes, because I've been here before." But I was very surprised yesterday when I looked at this woman in line for supper, and she looked at me like she was seeing a ghost or something, and she suddenly came into focus, and I realized it was someone I'd lived here during the winter with on staff in 75, and she was here with her husband, and they were here with another friend who also was on staff in 75, and their three children, and whatnot. And so we just hugged each other and just sort of went, ah, you know, and really it was kind of amazing, because you just realize how disconnect, how it, you can live in the same state or adjacent, but you don't stay in touch or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just mildly putting it. And then talking about how our lives have gone, and you know, just a real, and then one son, her friend's son, who I went to college with, who I hadn't seen since college, is in New York, and one is in Portland, and you know, and so forth, and realizing these various roads that we all take, and then we have been coming back. They had been coming to Holden many times, which I didn't know. And I have my family's had a strong connection in other ways to Holden, starting with my parents, who were both deceased. And my dad was a Lutheran pastor, and he actually knew your grandfather, my father, Maury, the senior. And he died many years ago, so in 75, the same year that I was on staff here in the winter, because that's part of the reason I came, really, because I was dealing with that. And so you realize how things sometimes just come together and, like you said, return home in a way, and kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Hard to put into words exactly.
Yeah. Anyone else want to share how this was or share what they wrote?
I think the bear, thinking about the bears and then your story about the shark, it brought to mind kind of these generational stories, right? These irrational fears, right, that are kind of passed down from each generation. So it reminded me of a story of my grandmother who lived in the Michigan woods and was very afraid. Like, she would run from bears in the middle of the night as she went to the outhouse.
Right.
And she had this story of, you know, she was with her sister and she left her sister when she heard the bear coming because she justified it, well, someone had to live. So that was her.
To tell the story.
Yeah.
To tell the story.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
enough.
Oh,
yeah. So it made me, so from the last session, I wrote about a bear encounter. So I kind of pieced that together with this generation of bear encounters.
Cool.
But it's a larger,
like
facing this fear, right, of the unknown. And
Do you want to share what you wrote?
It's not quite done yet, but.
Yeah.
That's the process I went through.
Yeah. So. There's a big bear theme this week. That's what I was writing about too, again. Bears. Anyone have a unique kind of version of the we community? Take a weird angle on it.
I think that for me it was a little bit different than I expected going in because I was looking for the sort of we of the like, we return to our community and like we've disrupted, our norms have been disrupted, so their norms are disrupted.
Yep.
But I've been through like the experience of the last couple of weeks of like going around and seeing all of these people who I haven't been able to spend one-on-one time with in a few years. And having done that, there's been this split between people who sort of understand why I left my job, came out here, and people who don't understand. And the ones that understood, like there was this reestablishment of we with them, in that like I opened up and then they opened up about similar things. And so it's not, I guess I ended up writing this and finding a different community that I thought I would, and that was sort of interesting.
That's cool.
Yeah.
The avenue to the found community.
Yeah.
Anyone else want to, you just talk about what the process was? We've got 6 minutes, but someone's got to say something.
Well, I followed your chart or your drawing over there. And
yeah.
The quest for me was going on a trip to Israel, which I was very afraid of because of the danger over there and also a health problem I had that I didn't know if I should be away that long. But there was a lady at our church who said, Well, the tour guides, they always know where all the trouble is, so I don't think that's a problem. So that kind of settled my nerves on that.
Yeah.
And then encountering the unknown. Well, when I got there, it didn't seem like a real unknown place. Like when we had to drive from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to get to our hotel, and that was just really pleasant, you know. And then when we got into Jerusalem and unloaded our luggage, we had to take our luggage across cobblestones to the hotel, and it just seemed, you know, just really nice and ordinary. There was no, it wasn't this real unknown experience. But I still had to keep pinching myself that, you know, I'm here in Israel. I just didn't believe it. And then the next day we got there, we had to go through Hezekiah's tunnel. Anybody's familiar with that, but it's a tunnel that they made in the old days, and I guess they started. There was one group working at this end and one working at that end, and they all met in the middle and were able to.
Wow.
And through it, water runs. So when you go through there, you have to walk through water.
Yeah.
And that was done so that they would, I guess the country was going to be under siege by somebody, and so they had to make sure they had a water supply, so that's why they did it. Anyway, the tour guide, after it was over, says, well, I guess you can survive this trip, because that was the worst part. And I guess I was, for the transformation, when I came back, I just felt, I don't know, strengthened in a way that I could have survived what I was so afraid of. And I did tell people about it. I told one lady, well, I lost my chili hat in the Church of the Hope, no, where Jesus was born, Church of the Nativity. And she just, well, she'd been there too, but I mean, she just breathed it off, oh, so what kind of thing. And then people would ask me, what did you do when they were there? And when you were there, I had a hard time telling them. I just couldn't just list.
Right.
It took a while to kind of get it sorted out in my mind. And I guess the biggest wee part was that somebody at the church suggested that I give a presentation on this. And we always have what they call Family of the Week. All the families of the week for certain months get together and have dinner. So afterwards, I gave this presentation, and it was really a big turnout. They were very interested.
Wow.
I was glad of that.
Yeah, you got to share that whole journey. Yeah. Yeah.
Just one thought. I won't read what I wrote, but
that's
mine. But in my life, you know, I used to take poetry classes. I used to do things. I taught English for many years. But writing down my own thoughts has not been part of my life recently. Or, you know, it's just not something I do. So I appreciate the return to that kind of concept.
Yeah, good. So. Yeah, well, I'm glad. Yeah, it's a thing, you know, these things come and go. It's the impulse to write, the impulse to narrate our lives, the impulse to create art or bring a story back to a community, that comes and goes. But I think it's important on another level to remember that this is part of a great tradition. And this is not just about a creative writing class. This is how we identify ourselves as families, as human beings, as people from the Lutheran faith, people from the Midwest, wherever we're from. Regionally, there are stories that get attached. In every family, there are these stories. And part of the, I think, one of the tragedies of the American identity is that so many of these stories have been sort of erased or, you know, willingly kind of forgotten about. I had to go into research mode to kind of find my family's stories of immigrating here from Norway, and I think my family was willing to tell those stories, but because of the way the American kind of identity zeitgeist worked, right? It was an erasure of poverty, an erasure of some of the pasts that were uncomfortable in order to form a new identity. But we really lose something in doing that. And that's just sort of unrelated, but that's just something that I've gone through in my life, trying to reclaim for my identity and for my community in some small way a sense of that journey and a sense of where we came from and where we might be going.
I don't think that's unusual at all. I mean, my story of that is my father came from a part of Germany that's now Poland, Pomerania.
Yeah.
It was ceded to Poland at the end of World War II. He came when he was 12 years old, 13 years old, in 1911.
Right.
I didn't know the story.
Right.
And he died before I was smart enough to ask him any questions. So we had to go back to find this little village that he grew up in. And of course its name had been changed from something that was German into something that was Polish.
Right.
But we found it.
Right.
And it was a downright spiritual experience to go there for me, it was.
Yep.
To go there and to see what this little village was like when here's a 13-year-old boy who's leaving this and going to America.
Right.
And it's still profoundly amazing to me, but it's a story. Right. And I had to, for the we part of that, I guess, in return, I had to put it in a book and send it to his grandchildren.
Wow.
And his children. So,
I mean, that'll be a treasure.
Some of that story.
Yeah. Well, good for you for doing that. I mean, these are not hard or not easy to kind of mine out sometimes and figure out. And I just want to emphasize that at the end here that we're not on these journeys just for ourselves, and we're not a beholden just for ourselves and just to get some fresh air and to have a little vacation. I always, when I leave this place, I feel energized and I feel stronger, right? And I just feel ready to go, and I've analyzed what that's about. And at first I thought, oh, it's because you do so much hiking around the village. And maybe a little bit, but like if you're up here for a week, you're not hiking miles and miles enough to feel like significantly stronger. I thought maybe it's the altitude, I get all this high mountain air and that makes me feel better. Maybe it's the food, you know, but I really think that it's this communal engagement up here and the conversations and the story and the kind of devotion to, you know, sacred spaces together and sharing language in sacred spaces. Those are the things I think that really bring me back and the reasons that I feel more fully myself and more human when I leave. So that's just, you know, more food for thought, but I have gone through that process a little bit on my own with this place. And, you know, there's something that does build a collective strength identity here. It's not just about being on vacation. So, anyway, thank you all for being here. Thank you for sharing.
Do we have to give your poems back?
The what?
We have to give your poems back, Kai.
Which ones?
The one you just passed out?
Oh, no, keep those. There's more poems that we didn't get to that are about the return, but those are for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.